This Dharma talk was given to the Clearway Zen Sangha by Lotus Vu. This talk is made available free of charge. More information about Clearway Zen can be found at www.clearwayzen.ca.
When we study Buddhist practice, we often hear the three trainings as established by the Buddha. What are the three trainings? The first is sila, or the taking on of guidelines or precepts for us to follow, observe, and live by. These are meant to help us cultivate the ability to establish mindfulness and tranquility with less disturbance. The second training is concentration, or many people recognize that as the word jhana. Nine successive levels of concentration to establish tranquility. Word concentration or focus is something that doesn't describe it as well. The jhanas are a very particular way of establishing focus and attention. And the third training that comes out from the first two, and without the first two, there can be no successive third training that can be done, is the training of wisdom, intuitive wisdom or intuitive knowing. It's a different form of knowing than the intellectual knowing that we often experience in everyday life. In Buddhism, this is called prajna or panna, and you hear it spoken often in every single one of our meetings or sittings with the resuscitation of the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra speaks to this very wisdom of intuitive awareness. It speaks to this very wisdom that allows the liberation from suffering to occur. And the Buddha says, this wisdom comes about from the practice of mindfulness combined with the first two training. When I first learned about the three training, and often in Vietnamese temple, when you walk in, they would have it written outside the hall, the Buddha hall, where all the ceremonies are taken, while the meditation is happening, in the case of Zen monasteries. And I take it to heart in a very young age that these three trainings are the absolute foundation of the practice. Without it, if you're like you're missing a leg, you have nothing to stand on. But people usually see these three trainings as two distinct, separate, discrete thing, except that when you start to practice, you realize it's not. It happens at the same time. Now imagine if you're busy kind of breaking the precepts, like stealing something. How is your jhana at that moment? how is your mindfulness at that moment? Right? Your mind would be thoroughly disturbed because of the fact that you're afraid of getting caught. You're looking around, you're in a state of heightened anxiety. You're a little, probably a little paranoid of other people watching you, or you know, not doing it fast enough that you risk being found out. And as I was walking the dog this morning, I saw two people try to climb over somebody's fence to get into their yard. And it was quite far away. I looked at them and they realized that I found out. And so they quickly scurried away. And so if we're busy violating one of the precepts, how good is the other two training now? Obviously not, right? So when we sit down to practice, to do our meditation, our body is not violating the precepts. Hopefully our mind is not violating the precepts. Because there's two levels of observing of the precepts, observing the body so that your behavior doesn't violate it. And the second is observing the mind so your mind doesn't start to entertain it or plan it, right? And so when we sit down with our body being purified of our action, because we're not in that moment violating any precepts, hopefully. And in our mind, in that moment, not violating any precepts, we start to establish focus and attention. And so we hold our focus and attention to something that is wholesome, our breath. And our breath is the root of our life, actually. So knowing the breath and how it functions and what's happening in that moment is pretty important. So we establish, focus our attention on the breath. But then what do you find out happens when you start to try to keep your focus and attention on the breath, right? The mind wanders. And then you have to bring your attention back to the breath. Well, what essentially are you doing in that moment? Without the recognition that your mind wanders, you can't bring your mind back to focus and attention on the breath. That is mindfulness, you see? So we're doing three things at the same time when we're sitting down to practice, right? We're doing all three trainings at the same time. So without mindfulness, you're not aware enough to realize what's going on in your mind. Is it dull? Is it wandering? Is it agitated? Is it bored? is it in sloth and torpor, half falling asleep, or, you know, in the vegetative state of sitting in front of the TV and just kind of half aware, sort of like below awareness a little bit, just tuning out. In that state, we're very easily suggestive. You know, we've been easily suggested, and that's why commercial airing on these channels are very expensive. So, establishing our mindfulness helps us to establish our jhanas, our focus attention. Relax, focus attention, jhana, Buddha. Successive states of establishing focus. And so through these three trainings, we've learned that they all happen at the same time. They all needed each other in order to happen at the same time. Without it, your practice cannot progress. Just imagine if someone was violating society's rules, some sort of a rule, I don't know, that maybe it's not an illegal one, but one that violates a social norm. For example, go and cheat on your spouse. How does your mind feel at that point? How does your mind behave at that point? It is certainly not a wholesome state. Not at all. Because at that point, you are in the grip of obsession. Given into obsession. Given into base desire. Drives you, whatever unconsciously drives you. And then, and knowing that, you know, that action is wrong, there's a sense of wrongness inside that we all carry this sense inside of us, you know, feel very uncomfortable. As you practice over time, you notice that every time you violate the precepts, there's a stirring inside, there's a discomfort inside that it's very pronounced. As you are able to go deeper into the different jhanas and able to establish mindfulness in everyday life in your practice, there's no point violating any precepts. Why? Because you can feel the discomfort inside your body as you're saying, telling that white lie. It's like there's no point doing it. It feels gross. So, you know, the Buddha says, once somebody experienced Kensho, there's a very slim chance of them violating the precepts. Why? Because they become increasingly aware of what it does to their internal self. And so, why would you do it? It's like eating McDonald's and knowing you're going to feel gross afterwards. Why would you do it to your body? It just doesn't make sense, right? When you're unaware, that's fine. You just stuff your face and get it over with and just satisfy it. You know, the desire in the moment. The fries are great, but it's completely filled with lard. Right? So, yeah, it tastes great. Lard tastes great. But it's the results afterwards. It's the digestion or the indigestion afterwards that your body feels gross. And why would you do it to yourself if you're mindful enough to be aware and in touch with your body? So the dedicated meditator does the same thing. They are always mindful, aware, and present of what goes on in their body and mind at all moments. Whether they're waking, working, walking, doing things, on the loo, whatever. Just mindful every moment of your experiences. To know what you do would cause discomfort in your body and mind. And why would you do them? If you know the results is going to be felt inside. And become increasingly aware of it. So the Buddha says the practice, the three trainings, is a practice of helping us to purify our body and mind. Oh, I remember when I was young, like fatty food, fried food, fast food. But I haven't really taken the practice to the level of being completely aware of every moment and every day. It wasn't until I Kensho that I started to do that I realized the stuff I was putting in my body was very unhealthy. Because I you know, become acutely aware of what happens afterwards. Well, so then I gradually just changed the habit out of being acutely aware of the effects of what I'm doing. Also, we become acutely aware and you know, very aware of the subtle changes in our body and mind. The little anxiety that rises, maybe not little for some of you, but, you know, or the discomfort that arises at certain experiences. And then you question yourself, well, why would I do that to myself again? Right? So The Buddha says that our life is fraught with suffering, with dissatisfaction and disappointment. So you start to be mindful of things in your day, in your everyday life, and watch the mind as it moves. And it grabs onto objects, it grabs onto ideas, and it creates expectations, and it grabs onto desire. And it creates a setup for disappointment. So when we are completely at the throes of its mercy, suffering follows us like an ox being drawn, drawing a cart behind it. This is what the Buddha taught. So it is very important to observe our mind, not just on the cushion, but if you can, observe it in everyday life, in all activity. Watch it, diligent, like a cat watching a mouse hole, ready to catch, spring into action and catch it when the mouse just peeks out of the hole. Mindfulness is that kind of alertness. Mindfulness is that kind of attention. If we're able to practice like that, our path towards liberation is very short and quick. But the problem is, we have this idea that there is that time that I sit down and practice and do my practice. And then there's the time that I put on the work hat and I go to work and I put on that, you know, that personality, you know, whatever I needed for work, and I do that. And what I discover is that that's not true at all. The practice can be taken everywhere. And the more your practice improves, the more whatever activity that you do, significant. It's not just in the quality of the activity, but in the quality of your experience of that activity. So it demonstrates very clearly that the mind is the chief, is the leader, determiner in whether or not we are happy, we are content, or we are dissatisfied. Because every moment, every day, every present moment, it's constantly creating a reality that could be a setup for dissatisfaction or a setup for liberation. It is up to us to understand it and choose the latter. Now, people think that the practice is very difficult. There's a great poem by the third patriarch called Faith in Mind. First, there's many stanza in that poem, and it's very beautiful piece of literary work. And he's, you know, just for the first four lines, says it all about the practice. He says, "The great way is not difficult. Just don't pick and choose." A little bit of steering from the path heaven and earth divide. And for those who experience Kensho, you probably realize that this is so. It comes to the point where you're walking between heaven and earth, and there's this really fine line in between, just a little bit stirring off. It's like, oh my God. it's incredibly uncomfortable. And if we're not yet there, that's okay. You already probably see in your own mind how much activity is going on. And probably even the unconscious activity, how much is going on without your awareness. As you slowly establish the practice to be able to become aware, to be able to focus your mind and see deeper into various facets. So this is a practice. People think that it's very difficult, that it's three distinct things. It's not. Precepts are not commandments. They're guidelines. I tell people, I said, I took them when I was very young. I was a child. Because when I got, became my teacher's student, I was only 7, 8 years old. So I took them when I was very young. Well, they didn't give it to me until much later when I was a teenager. But then, you know, teenagers are known to break rules. So I didn't understand what they were about. But as I discover through my meditation practice, if you break them, guess what happens to your body and mind? They're not rules, they're guidelines. They help us to be able to stay on the path, to stay on the course without much mental, emotional disturbance. So the precepts, when you break them, usually we have a ceremony where people go and confess and tell another practitioner or tell their teacher or tell the Sangha what they did. And it's not about trying to absolve your sins. It's about understanding what led you there and what are the elements that got you caught up in there. How can you get out? And how can you refrain from walking that path again in the future? Which caused disturbance in body and mind? Difficult to liberate from that. And so the practice of the precept is that. That's why when I hear people talk in Buddhist circles about teachers who break a precept, and they'll say, oh, I'm very enlightened, I'm above precepts. And I'm thinking, no way. Not happening, not what I experience. You can't expect to breach the precepts and not have a reaction in your body and mind, which essentially will throw you out of the jhanas, okay, of your ability to concentrate. And if it throws you out of the jhanas, good luck trying to establish clarity and mindfulness. It's not happening, okay? So I don't agree with crazy wisdom, people breaking precepts and saying that they're still enlightened away. That's just excuse for misbehavior. For me, it's very clearly demonstrated in my own experience, my own practice. And I tell you, I broke them before, not major ones, but minor ones. I haven't killed anybody, but I can tell you that every time I do, it affects my practice. It affects my ability to establish deep concentration in the jhanas. It affects my ability to cultivate wisdom and mindfulness, mindful attention. It affects my ability for insight. So these things are not rules. There are guidelines for practice. And the jhanas, you know, there's many people who talk about the jhanas in ways that they don't understand or they don't know at all and have no direct experience. When I was growing up in Vietnam, and I think this is not just Vietnam, Thailand too, from what I know, and Cambodia and many different places, is that the general belief among Buddhist practitioners and even Theravada and Mahayana practitioners is that the jhanas is unattainable. It's just people just don't get the jhanas. There's no one being able to establish the jhanas in the practice anymore. So we're just gonna have to contend that it's too hard and nobody can do it in the modern age. And you know, I always wonder about these things, because in the text the Buddha talked about it in ignosium. Why would he teach the jhanas and talk about it in ignosium if it cannot be done by people? It just doesn't make any sense. And the Buddha is a very, very reasonable, logical person. Okay? So, I had a doubt. I doubted these common beliefs that was going on. And these beliefs probably serve to stop people from practicing the jhanas, or stop people from deeply practicing meditation for a practice, because they were telling me when I was growing up that it's too difficult. It's reserved for special people. It's reserved for people with special abilities or karma that has been cultivated for many lifetimes. And I can tell you, I didn't do that. When I was a child, I remember my past life, and I was definitely a schmuck. I did not cultivate such, okay? So I doubted it, because I saw, you know, that I encountered Buddhism pretty early, despite all the horrible things I did in last life. Of course, you know, it's the standard, you know, corruption, you know, kind of thing. Government worker, very corrupt, standard issue in many societies. So still, there was not some good things that I did. I still encountered a dharma. What luck, right? I met my teacher when I was 5 years old. My mother took me to so many different temples. I had the great pleasure of meeting the great Thathanta, who became a renowned, you know, Zen teacher in Vietnam. I had the great pleasure to meet Thich Nhat Hanh, who was a great teacher worldwide, and study there with them. And I had the great pleasure to meet my teacher. So, I mean, I definitely didn't cultivate all those good karma. Okay? So, I was definitely not special. So, I still did the jhana, because none of that idea stuck in my mind. I never believed them. Because if you believe them, it becomes an obstacle in your own mind, and you won't be able to do it. And so I did the jhanas without even thinking about the jhanas. They just happen. They just happen as you cultivate, you know, a good practice, a good daily practice. As you sit down and desire nothing and just relax and just become aware and, you know, just do the basic. Bring your attention back to the breath. Relax. Just let go of everything that comes up. That's all I did. And with the establishment of the jhanas, this whole series of insights started coming. And every single one of these insights untangle a web of conceptual, I call it conceptual prison, that locked ourselves. I locked myself. And these conceptual prisons have to do with cultural inheritance. Not okay, not just social inheritance from your parents, from your family, but cultural inheritance as well. So there's a lot of things in Buddhism that are culturally inherited that I had to unlearn. Surprise, surprise. I did not know that when I truly practiced Buddhism, I've unlearned a lot of the stuff I've learned in Buddhism. And so And why do we have to unlearn the things that we've learned in the beginning? Because they were stepping stones. They were the format for us to be able to step onto the next part of our practice. Without those stepping stones, it's kind of hard to get into the gates of the practice. But once you finish that step, well, you don't carry the step with you. You have to let it go, right? Who would carry, you know, the stairs with them? Jesus, because rolling up the stairs behind you. It's just, no, it's not good to do that. So at some point, even Zen itself have to undo all the concepts that came up with Zen. Until there's nothing left. And then you realize that all of life is constructed by this web of conceptual reality. And there's a dimension in reality that stands outside and apart from this. That is non-changing. Forever there. Always present. Until you get a taste of that reality, very hard to untangle that web. Why do we untangle the web? Well, we untangle the web so we're not can be free from it. As I like to say, you can live with it, but still be free from it. Right? You can be in the world, but not of the world. To touch on a reality that's completely different from one of desire and suffering, from one of dissatisfaction. A reality that is indescribable, as the Buddha calls it. So I'm not going to begin to describe it because he tried so hard. And inevitably, everybody who tries fails. They know that, but they keep trying. And Zen practice is that. Ultimately, every Dharma talk that I do, I know that I fail at pointing out that reality. But I keep trying. Why? Because without acknowledging or giving people at least some hope that it's there, it's possible, it's present, we're not going to even begin to practice. We're not going to even begin to try to discover it. We're not going to get ourselves on the cushion. And most importantly, we're not going to ask important questions to uncover that path. So our practice is about constantly questioning, having an open mind, somewhat doubtful of things here, questioning our own beliefs, questioning our own reality, questioning our own reaction to things. Is it really coming from outside or is it just me? And so this is our practice. And the deeper we go in our practice, the more interesting it gets. Unless you're occupied by something else. What I find with the practice is that I'm never bored. Boredom is a state of mind associated with the need for stimulation. And the need for stimulation is the need for distraction from yourself, from your own mind. But there's enough in your mind to discover that is super interesting. You don't need to go anywhere else. You don't need to look anything else.
This podcast is created by members of the Clear Way Zen Sangha. you enjoyed the talk and wish to show support, donation information can be found on our website, www.clearwayzen.ca. Thank you for listening.